From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we break down the last gubernatorial debate.
What I saw was two folks that were trying to get out of the second debate with as least amount of damage as possible, and I think one of them did a better job than the other one on that fact.
Detroit carmakers get dinged in the newest Consumer Reports reliability survey.
You know, there are 29 brands that were rated by readers of Consumer Reports. The first American Ford doesn't come in till about place 17.
We talk with 7th District GOP Congressman Tim Walberg and Democratic challenger Gretchen Driscoll.
We need a balanced democracy, and we don't have a balanced democracy right now.
And two priests at the start and end of their careers.
You know what, Jim? I'd say this. Love the people.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Republican Bill Schuette and Democrat Gretchen Whitmer traded barbs last night in one final gubernatorial debate before the election.
Bill Schuette shows up when the cameras are on, but when no one's watching, he makes decisions that hurt us.
My opponent's agenda, Gretchen Whitmer and Garland Gilchrist, one word for it, friends, extreme, way extreme.
With us now is Adrian Hemond. He's a Democratic strategist and CEO of the Grassroots Midwest Bipartisan Consulting Firm. And Matt Marsden is here, a GOP strategist who's director of public relations and government affairs at Rev6 Data Systems. So did anything last night surprise you, Matt?
I think that the performance by Bill Schuette was a little bit canned, but I think the barbs were to be expected, and I think that the subject matters continue to float along the same pattern line. But overall, I think that, I've had my differences with Gretchen Whitmer in the past. I think she did a fine job, and I think she dealt with the issues fairly straightforward.
All right, and what's your impression, Adrian?
Yeah, I was surprised, frankly, at how poorly the AG performed last night. If there's one thing that Bill Schuette's known for, it's being a polished, consummate politician. And that was not Bill Schuette last night. That's not the Bill Schuette we've been used to for the last 30 years.
You have any sense of why that was? Because I saw that repeated on social media. What do you think was going on, Matt?
I think it was sticking too close to these talking points, these GOP talking points, and not getting off of them and returning back to the same point over and over and over again. And it seems very canned. It seemed very, you know, just I'm just going to repeat what I've been told to repeat, and I'm going to try and put my head down and get through this. And it just looked very uncomfortable.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As the questioning began, they each got their opening statement, and then moderator Devin Scillian of WDIV-TV, he asked the candidates, talk about your plans, don't take shots at your opponent. And then for the next hour, Gretchen Whitmer made very sure to repeat that she thinks Bill Schuette's been asleep at the wheel for the 33 years he's been in office. And from Bill Schuette, he made a mantra out of Gretchen Whitmer was in Lansing 14 years, passed three bills, and she'll take Michigan back to the dark Granholm years. And we heard that for the entire hour. What do you think as far as getting off these talking points and punching the opponent? You're both consultants. Does that old repetition really, really work with voters?
Not now. Not today. People are upset about the divisiveness of the conversation and the political discourse that's going on. I don't think that it helps. I don't think that it helps that it happened yesterday on a day when we saw these bombs being sent out, and we've got the president that's out there talking about bashing the media and how they're responsible for the hostility, and then we're watching hostility last night. And I think that the voters really want to hear about the issues, and I'm not so sure that they're properly explaining, like roads, for instance. Okay, great. Now, you're going to fix the roads. How are we going to do that? What about the gas tax that was already passed? What about the birthday tax that the governor put on our registration fees? Where is that money going? How is it being effectively spent? Just saying road fixing is not going to do it. Auto insurance, great, okay. I don't know that the entire state of Michigan really fully understands the problem with auto insurance and how it specifically is tailored to the problems of Detroit.
All right, I want you to chime in with your perspective on that, Adrian.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I think Senator Whitmer did a slightly better job of offering some specifics about some of her plans, but the bar was set pretty low. You know, both of them spent a good deal of the debate, as you pointed out, attacking each other for being career politicians, which was pretty comical since I think that label is safely applied to both of them.
Well, you know, when you think about that 1 hour, there were 13 issues plus their opening and closing statements. So with those 13 questions about issues, we heard non-answers from both, as you very clearly said. So, for instance, Whitmer didn't say clearly what she would do about immigration and whether she would make Michigan a sanctuary state. Schuette didn't directly answer the question about the Nestle water deal. Neither touched the question about how they would fix Michigan's mental health system. What do all of these non-answers tell us, Adrian?
You know, I think from the Whitmer campaign, it makes perfect sense, right? She's been leading in every poll that we've seen. Her task last night was not to screw up. And I think that she did that, you know, very well. From the attorney general, it's a little less clear what he got out of that. I think he needed to be more aggressive in terms of offering some plans, offering something to differentiate himself from Senator Whitmer besides talking points. And I thought he really stumbled. I think there were a couple of real missed opportunities there. His answer to the auto insurance question was atrocious, and that was a real missed opportunity for him. He didn't really say much of anything. And then when Senator Whitmer got to rebut that, she got to talk about Mayor Duggan's endorsement, which was how the question was framed to the attorney general. And he really dropped the ball on that.
And I want the Republican strategist perspective on all of this.
I think it should have been less canned responses and more discussion on policy. If you're going to demonstrate that you want to move from being the attorney general to being the governor of the state of Michigan and not having held a legislative position for as many years as he has, you need to better demonstrate that he has an agenda other than just saying, I have a paycheck plan. Well, that's lovely. But what kind of jobs are those going to create? Where are you planning on creating them? What sectors do you want to improve on? I think that the Elliot Larson question was handled horribly. I think that Elliot Larson is a very straightforward issue. If we want talent to come to the state of Michigan, we had our business community very early on trying to get that bill changed to make it so that people are not discriminated against in the workplace or in the housing market or anywhere, frankly. And it's really simple to just say, I want to fix that because A, it's going to allow more talent to come to the state of Michigan. Dan Gilbert was arguing for it. The MEDC was arguing for it a while ago. It's not a difficult change. It really isn't a difficult change to just amend the Elliot Larson Act and say that you're not going to discriminate against folks and you're going to have more talent that's going to come to Michigan and create jobs. There's a specific way you could have addressed the jobs right there in and of itself.
And the question about whether you would make Michigan a sanctuary state. Adrian, were you satisfied with Gretchen Whitmer's non-answer?
I mean, from a political perspective, it made perfect sense. She did a nice job of pivoting off of that question because she doesn't want to answer it. And I think that was the right move for her. But, I mean, it was obviously a complete non-answer. You know, Schuette could have done better, I think, in his follow-up to that. Frankly, I think that her non-answer, again, presented him with an opportunity to get into specifics about why he thinks Michigan being a sanctuary state is a bad idea. Whatever you think about that policy issue, he had an opportunity to really spell out why she's extreme about this issue from his perspective, why what he's purporting that she wants to do would be bad for the state. He didn't do that. He just said over and over again that she wanted to do it. Well, why should voters care about that? If that's not an issue that motivates you already, which would put you squarely in Bill Schuette's base, I would think, why should you care?
We're talking with Adrian Heman, Democratic strategist, and Matt Marsden, a GOP strategist, breaking down the final Michigan gubernatorial debate. Did you hear any aha moments, direct, real answers that gave you insight into policy, Matt?
I didn't see anything that was a real wow moment. What I saw was two folks that were trying to get out of the second debate with as least amount of damage as possible, and I think one of them did a better job than the other one on that fact. But I don't think that we got any real new policy ideas or anything that's going to really drive those voters that aren't already supporting them to the polls to vote for them on November.
That's what I wondered, Adrian. Was there any moment or anything served up by either candidate you think might have won over an undecided voter?
No, I don't think so, other than the fact that, you know, for folks who are undecided at this point, these are going to tend to be very politically disengaged folks. And if those folks watched the debate last night, I think it's fair to say that Senator Whitmer turned in a much more human performance than the attorney general did. And that could have some marginal benefit for her. But in terms of policy detail, straightforward answers, anything like that, neither candidate really did much of that. Senator Whitmer didn't really need to, and the attorney general didn't.
You know, these TV debates, like, for example, last night's, it ran 1 hour, so 13 issues plus opening and closing statements. So every candidate got 60 seconds. And they were hard and fast about it. Devin and Kimberly,
he did a great job.
Boom, pulled the plug after 60 seconds and then 30 seconds for rebuttal. some complicated issues were served up. What do you think about these TV debates and what can be done with that? What can a candidate do in 60 seconds?
Not very much, and I'm not sure how much they're watched. I think it's important because it puts the candidates on the spot. They have to be there. They have to deliver, and you're going to get a good sense of what their presentation is. And in this instance, I would give a lot of credit to the moderators because I think they did a very good job of trying to keep this thing moving down the road and getting the questions answered. And in stopping the rebuttals on time, they were stopping a further mudfest from happening, frankly. But I don't think that these debates are very highly covered or viewed, but I think they're important. It's important for our public officials to have to go before the public and make their case. And it does give the public some sense, if they are watching, what they're dealing with. Are they stiff? Do they look believable? Are they relatable? And in this instance, I agree with Adrian that Gretchen Whitmer seemed much more relatable in terms of her performance and much more sincere.
There's 12 days left until the election. Adrian, what needs to happen for each candidate to be able to pull it over and win? What do you see having to happen?
You know, for Senator Whitmer, I think it's sort of steady as she goes from a communications perspective. The big thing is got to turn people out to vote. Republican turnout in gubernatorial elections tends to be more or less steady. There's a little fluctuation at the margins. But Republicans are typically going to turn out more or less the same number of voters every gubernatorial election. When Democrats turn their voters out, they win. When they don't, they lose. And so I think the big task for her right now is getting out the vote. From the perspective of, you know, the attorney general, he needs some sort of game changer in this race. He's been behind in every public poll that's come out. I expect those to tighten a little bit as his base comes home. But he's got to do something to capture independents. And one of the things that's been really interesting and clear from the last several polls that have come out is he's losing independents right now. And if he loses independents, it's going to be bad for his campaign and it's going to be bad for down ballot Republicans.
I think that what needs to happen primarily is the absentee voters. It's the ones that are not returned right now. These campaigns on either side should be looking at anybody that has not returned their absentee ballot and should be doing a direct communication with them, be it a door knock or be it a phone call, to get those ballots off of those kitchen counters and get them back in. That's going to be a decisive factor in this. We've seen a serious uptick in absentee voters. And then I think on game day, they have to turn out the vote. And it's on the Democrats to really make sure that they not only have taken care of their absentee ballot side of things, and they have to turn their voters out on election day. And they really need to target those non-traditional off-presidential year voters and get them motivated to get there. On the Republican side, Adrian's correct. The Republicans are very traditional in their turnout models, and they're very traditional in their return of absentee ballots. And we've seen that consistency in our tracking at Rev6. That they are returning at the same pace that they are, not as much in some certain areas, but we are seeing an uptick in participation in absentee ballots that we haven't seen in past years.
GOP strategist Matt Marsden of Rev6 Data Systems and Democratic strategist Adrian Heyman of Grassroots Midwest Consulting Firm. It's always a pleasure. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Much more to come. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Two big metrics for a company are the value of its stock and the perceived quality of its products. And in both of those, there is some interesting news for the Detroit car makers. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here now. Daniel, let's start with the annual reliability survey from Consumer Reports. What is the news for Detroit car makers?
It's grim. Mm. I thought, you know, there were 29 brands that were rated by readers of Consumer Reports. The first American, Ford, doesn't come in till about place 17. And I should also add that Tesla is in this as well. And it's not just Detroit. And Tesla is almost dead last. It's 27 out of 29 in terms of reliability. And important to note, this comes from readers, not from professional critics.
So these are the people buying the cars.
That are buying the cars, that are driving their Buicks and Cadillacs and Fords and the Hondas and their Toyotas and Lexuses, which we ranked, by the way, first and second. Hmm. The Japanese, I think, had 5 out of the top 10. Couple of Koreans in there, a couple of Germans, rounding out by Mini, which I think was number 9, and of course they're owned by BMW. So,
yeah.
So a lot of the processes that BMW uses would reflect into that brand.
And yet the narrative has been around this part of the world is, gee, Detroit's products are better than they've been in decades.
Well, I think they are, but like a lot of other things we talk about, you're not against the static competition. The competition's moving as well. And if you benchmark to yourself to the way the competition was 6-8 years ago, Yeah, we are better. And I think you drive a lot of these American products and you think, wow, these are great. I mean, I drive a Jeep Grand Cherokee and I think a lot of it's pretty bulletproof. However, it doesn't test out very well and the reliability on them is not necessarily so hot. I think this is a real problem. And this is it reflected in everything from stock prices to transaction prices, depending on what the product is and who they're competing against. And I've had some occasion to see some Japanese vehicles lately, and I've been very impressed with how much they're packing in and what they're offering to consumers for a lot better price. So this is, I think, one wake-up call that we're seeing is that, you know, you think you're there and you're not there. This competitive, it's constantly competitive globally. And I'm not suggesting that some of the people inside these companies don't understand this. I think they really do. But I think that what matters is what those of us on the outside are seeing and feeling every day we get in our cars, and do we have problems, and are we going to the dealer, and, you know, do we have blank screens in our infotainment systems, and all those kinds of things that can really be aggravating to folks.
And then touching on a story in the front page of the Detroit News, a double standard about how the market reacted to reports of third quarter profits at Ford and Tesla. What's going on?
Well, Tesla hasn't had a quarterly profit in a very, very long time, and they finally post a quarterly profit at a very critical time as they're launching their Model 3, and in after-hours trading, the stock's up 30%. Meanwhile, Ford comes out, says, we've done another $1 billion. Our cash hoard's up to $23.7 billion. Our profit margins are continuing to go up, which is what we've said we were going to be doing. And they're up about 4% in after-hours trading.
So Wall Street gives Tesla a great big pat on the back, and Ford gets a shrug. Why?
Well, I think it's emblematic of where we are, that essentially the investment community and the smart people looking for where the future is going in the industry is saying they're betting much more on Silicon Valley types like Tesla and potentially Waymo from Google and others than they are on the Detroit car companies. I think they're saying two things. One is, we're not convinced you guys can survive difficult times. You've had nothing but good times since about 2010. And number two, we're not convinced that legacy companies with 100 years of corporate tradition and culture can move quickly enough and be innovative enough and take enough risk to prosper in Auto 2.0. That's not me saying it. I think that's what the market is telling people. If you look at what's happening to the stocks of the auto companies, the traditional auto companies, GM and Ford, for example, they're getting pounded in this environment right now. And I think that's because a lot of them look at them as still cyclical plays, that when rates go up and people stop buying cars as much, these companies are going to suffer.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
Closing in on Election Day, November 6th, we're visiting with statewide and congressional candidates around the state. Today, we hear from Congressman Tim Walberg, the Republican running for re-election in Michigan's 7th District. He recently spoke with stateside's Lester Graham.
In your campaign this year, you've been stressing bipartisanship, noting your work with Member of Congress Debbie Dingell, a Democrat who's from a district which borders yours. At the same time, the American Conservative Union and GovTrack both rank you as one of the most conservative members of Congress in Michigan. So how do you reconcile those two things, bipartisanship and being on one end of the political spectrum?
Well, we're probably emphasizing it because the other side is attempting to try to display me as a conservative that can't work with anybody, and that's just false. I think conservatives can work with people when you have good ideas that you can share, and whether it's Debbie Dingell or Dan Kildee on the Flint issue, water issue, or working with Representative Blunt Rochester from Delaware, former insurance state insurance commissioner on an annuity safe harbor bill that I authored, and she was my prime co-sponsor. When we can work together on those things, why not? When I can have a bill signed by President Obama, I'll take it. When he has a good idea that works for all of us, I certainly am willing to support that and have in the past. And the same is true with this new administration. So probably we've talked more about bipartisanship because there's been a pushback from the other side trying to display me as one who can't work simply because I'm a conservative.
I want to talk about a couple of positions. The Lansing State Journal asked you and your opponent about Proposal 2. That's the move to appoint an independent commission to draw legislative and congressional district maps and to end gerrymandering. Your opponent, Democrat Gretchen Driscoll, says she supports it. You didn't exactly say whether you support Proposal 2 or not. How will you be voting?
Well, I'll be voting no, very clearly. I'm not sure why it didn't come out that I'm opposed.
What he said was you served in districts drawn by both parties and right. The elections have consequences, which didn't make it clear to me. Maybe I'm just a little
slow. Elections do have consequences. And the beauty of the way we do it here in the state right now, the APOL plan, Bernie APOL was a Democrat who set the plan in place that we've functioned under for quite some time now. And during the last two reapportionments, there's been no objection that has been sustained or really brought forward by either party to what the districts were reapportioned into and redistricted into. And I think that's because we have that plan that requires the legislature to establish the plan based upon the requirements of the system, the Bernie APOL system. The governor has a say in it, and the Supreme Court ultimately has a say to say, did you follow the rules? We're also a voters' rights state, so you have to have a percentage of minority districts that are arranged so that it will be a minority district. I think that makes a problem for minorities, but that's the way it's set in law. So you have to do it. So there has to be some gerrymandered look just to get those districts into place. My concern is this voters, not politicians, is really not accurate in its title because it takes away the voters' responsibility and right and privilege to elect the people from their own districts who will establish the redistricting plan. That's the state legislature. And now it gives it to one person who will make the decision.
Well, 13 people.
Well, it's one person who will select those 13 people.
Right, the Secretary of State.
The Secretary of State, and that could be a Democrat or Republican, and so it's one person that selects those. And I think you can pick Republicans. I think you can pick Democrats. But people that are totally out of any party and have no relationship to a member of Congress or a precinct delegate or someone else, wow, it seems to me that that will cause significantly more problems with gerrymandering.
Let's talk about your district. What do you think the biggest problems the residents of the 7th District face right now?
I think what they face right now is the continuation of the positive growth that's taken place as a result, I think, of some policies both at the federal and state level that have produced jobs. Right now we're having a hard time filling those positions. Why do I say that's a problem? When you have a business person that for some time has had the struggle with just the economics issue, and now we have a growing economy, we have more jobs coming back to the United States and to Michigan, and we have plants, manufacturing facilities, engineering centers, hospitals that need nurses, and we don't have the people to fill those jobs, that can possibly frustrate the forward movement and giving more opportunities to individuals. So that's a key issue that we're looking at. Education is another, to make sure that we have the educational resources there, not only for K-12, but done in such a way that we encourage our young people and adults to find that sweet spot and then to have the training opportunities, whether it be in a four-year institution like the one we're surrounded here, University of Michigan, or whether it be an apprenticeship program, a certification training center, community college, anything that will provide training for people for real-world jobs that will give them a profession that they can expand in.
As you mentioned, there are manufacturers supplying auto companies in your district, and you've got a major automobile plant, the GM Delta plant, within your district. What do you think of the aluminum and steel tariffs that President Trump has levied on Canada?
Well, so far I think it's working. I'm not a tariff guy. I'm a free trade, fair trade guy. But as we've had the opportunity to look at what's going on with this administration, they're using tariffs as a tool or maybe even a weapon because that's what's in place right now, tariffs and taxes. And America for too long has been treated wrongly. And with disproportionate tariffs put on our goods. And so finally to have an administration that says it's got to end. And it will be a battle, maybe even result in a war. Of trade war, not with guns and missiles, but a trade war. But in the end, if it produces something that lasts for decades for the benefit of our citizens here in Michigan and other places, it's probably worth it. And so far what we're seeing with the most recent reorganization of NAFTA into a U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which I've had contacts from all of the entities in my district, GM, FCA, Chrysler, and Toyota, Ford have all contacted me and saying, hey, what we've seen with that new trade agreement seems to be working in our direction, especially with the requirements for the extensive North American content. So it appears to be working. We're seeing India now asking to come to the table. Korea, we've settled with Korea, I think a good trade agreement. Japan is now asking to reignite the process of working through a negotiation. And I think all of that says to China, you are being marginalized here very quickly with the European Union now buying soybeans and LNG from us. Putin and Russia has to take notice of that because that steps into what they've been selling over to the European Union states. So while it can have some mess, and while I've always wanted to be short-term and targeted, I think we're seeing some positive impact.
PFAS contamination is being discovered all over the state, as you know. It's just the latest legacy pollution problem that Michigan's facing. You've encouraged the EPA to relax environmental regulations on some businesses in some circumstances. Are you concerned that that could result in the next pollution issue contaminating the land, the water, or the air?
Well, you always have to have that concern. But you have to have the concern as well that you you cross that fine line or stay with that fine line between encouraging continued advancement in our industry, our business, our economy, as well as remain good stewards of the resources we have. Use it, but protect it as well. And I think that's why what I've encouraged has been in the area of regulations that don't deal with the actual environment, but really step into the place that there ought to be decisions made either at the state level or at the industry level themselves.
Can you give me an example?
Well, if you look at what took place with EPA pushing the Waters of the U.S. rules, they ought to be looking at our rivers and streams. That's their responsibility. They ought to be looking at the Great Lakes, making sure that we have Great Lakes Restoration Initiative fully funded. And we fought together as Republicans and Democrats here in the Great Lakes states and in Michigan specifically to make sure that it's remained fully funded, both when the last administration under Obama zeroed it out and when this administration zeroed out, and we kept it in. But most recently, we had an opportunity to bring EPA in and look at the PFAS situation. They're responsible there for those streams and rivers. But when we get to farm puddles, drainage ditches and the like, that's not their responsibility. We have DEQ and state resources to do that. And so you're taking away opportunities, responsibilities, and time and energy as well as dollars to do stuff that EPA ought to do.
That idea was to protect wetlands, which are, you know, the birthplace of all life for the waters, right? So
and
how
I
do you balance that?
And I truly think the DNR and DEQ in Michigan with feet on the ground can do a better job than EPA. And we saw that when the EPA relaxed what they were supposed to do with Flint, everything broke loose. And there was a failure at all levels of government. But EPA was responsible for that. And so getting into areas that can be dealt with and have been dealt with very well by our state's entities, natural resources, DEQ, and taking time away and dollars away from doing those things hurt. And I think PFOS, PFAS, that's something that we're finding now. There will be other things in the future. But if we keep in our sphere of influence as opposed to stepping out of boundaries, I think we'll be better off for it.
While we're on the subject of environment, I wanted to ask you, what do you think we should do about climate change?
Well, I think we should be remain stewards of the resources we have, but understand that climate change has gone on since the beginning. There have been cycles that have taken place. We've seen that. I've grown through some of those in my 67 years, and we've had changes. Are there man influences to climate? Oh, absolutely. I don't debate that at all. But I'd say let's make sure as well that we keep in perspective that America has gone an awful long way, a very long way, in cleaning up our problem and now sustaining good efforts on our resources. But other countries like India, China, et cetera, are the ones that we need to fixate on and push them to do what's necessary and not give them an agreement that says in 30 years, China, you'll come up with a plan. That's too late. Push back. They're the ones. The plume that's coming from China, for instance, impacts us more than what we're doing ourselves.
There was a report out that we've done a good job of reducing CO2 emissions from smokestack industries, but we haven't made the progress we can on tailpipe emissions because, one, people are driving more because there's more cheap gas and it's a big economy. And two, the president has decided that we are not going to have these requirements in the future that, that the Obama administration put in to reduce CO2 out of the tailpipe. What do you think of that?
Well, I think you need to look at the reality out there. We certainly have made significant impact on tailpipe emissions. You know, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I remember just constant smell of the diesel fuel from the buses, the cars belching smoke, the
truck. On those kinds of pollutants, but we're talking about CO2.
We're doing that. But we've also made improvements there as well. It comes down to the costs and the impact for the outcome. And right now, the excessive cost for a very limited impact should cause us to think, should we slow it down, still move that direction, but let's not frustrate economy that – for the first time, really, in history, we have true competitors around the world that are gaining on us rapidly and will impact our standard of living and even the way that we deal with those issues in the future of having the resources to do it. So while we need to keep progressing, let's do it in a legitimate way that that moves forward steadily but doesn't frustrate the rest of the economy.
Tim Walberg is the Republican representative of the 7th Congressional District. He's running for re-election. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
After the break, we'll speak with 7th District Democratic challenger Gretchen Driscoll. And then we'll hear from two Catholic priests about what it's like to be at opposite ends of the same career path. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We are bringing you interviews with the congressional candidates as we get closer to the midterm election day. Before the break, it was Republican Congressman Tim Walberg who was running for re-election. And now we hear from his opponent, Gretchen Driscoll, the Democrat running in the 7th District race. Here she is speaking with Stateside's Lester Graham.
This is the second time you've challenged the incumbent, Tim Walberg. Last time in 2016, he won with 55% of the vote. The boundaries were drawn to make the 7th a Republican district, so the odds are still not in your favor. Why run again?
I think the environment is completely different. It started back in 2017, January. I just went out and started listening after I finished my term in the State House, and a completely different environment, a lot of engagement and activism from all sorts of different groups, grassroots groups. County parties are a lot more active, the Democratic County Party. So just there's a completely different environment. And what I hear is people are still really hungry for change. It was a change election. People are anti-establishment, anti-D.C. Mr. Walberg is about what's worst about D.C., you know, with taking all this special interest money and really not showing up to help out in the communities in the district.
Both of you responded to questions from the Lansing State Journal. I was looking at those. You indicated you support Proposal 2, which would turn redistricting over to independent commission rather than let politicians draw the map. Walberg didn't answer the question directly, but he said he served in districts drawn by both parties and that elections have consequences. Why do you support this proposal to end gerrymandering in Michigan?
Because I think that we need a balanced democracy, and we don't have a balanced democracy right now. I think the voters are completely frustrated that we get more Democratic vote over the statewide, and yet that's not reflected right now in the State House. My district in—
Or in Congress.
Right,
yeah.
in Congress also, but my district in the State House, which is part of this whole 7th gerrymandering, is just wraps around completely around Ann Arbor. I mean, it's ridiculous, and there's some really tough districts around the state and the State House. And then my 7th congressional district that I'm running for, same thing. They basically took out the county that the Democratic congressperson was in, Calhoun County, so— It basically jumps around Calhoun County.
That's when Mark Schauer was
right,
the
exactly.
Yeah, rep. If you're elected, what's the first issue you'll tackle in Washington?
Campaign finance reform. I think it's ridiculous the amount of money.
Does that register with the voters? I mean,
yes.
You know, usually so it's the economy, right?
Well, I think the economy is really important, but I think in order to do good work on the economy, you need to have campaign finance reform and have disclosure on who's funding different campaigns. A lot of that is not transparent right now, and people are really cynical. Part of it is the gerrymandering that you mentioned, and part of it is that people feel like they are not being represented by their congressman because that person is being – their campaigns are being paid for by special interests. So there's a lot of cynicism out there right now. The economy is also a big issue, jobs, in particular good-paying jobs. The jobs that pay the bills close to home here in the 7th haven't really come back since the recession last decade. And so that's an issue I hear. You know, we have a lot of small towns across the 7th that are still trying to bring those jobs that pay decent wages. And there's a lot of things that we could be doing at the, you know, as a partner in Congress with the local communities.
Yeah, we should explain the 7th District. Basically, it takes in several counties on the bottom tier, right on the Ohio border, and then kind of snakes its way up to west side of Lansing,
right,
which is weird and something I want to talk about in a little bit. What do you think the biggest problem for residents of the 7th face?
Economic issues, and right now, affordable health care, prescription drug costs, economic insecurity. So health care, and then I hear a lot from seniors, you know, prescription drug pricing, and also they're feeling very vulnerable because of the skyrocketing deficit that's going to affect. You know, there's been talk at the federal level about cutting Social Security and Medicare, and I hear much more alarm about that right now than I heard 2 years ago. And well, we have a much bigger deficit than 2 years ago, so I think that's warranted because there have been discussions in D.C. about cutting.
I saw on your website that you supported President Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. The automakers and suppliers say those tariffs are hurting the industry. There are lots of parts suppliers and at least one major auto plant, the GM Delta plant in the 7th District. So why do you support the steel and aluminum tariffs?
Well, I support fair trade and the effort to have creative solutions. And I think that President Trump originally started out with trying to make sure that was the effort to have fair trade in steel dumping. You know, the dumping was an issue. I'm glad to see that we have worked on, you know, devil's in the details here with a new NAFTA, UMCA.
USMCA.
And I'm really glad to see that our Canadian, which is such a predominant trading partner and really, really important, that we have a strong trade relationship with them. So I just support fair trade in the 7th. We have a lot of folks that are disenfranchised because of automotive and the transition and the movement of jobs outside of the 7th that are automotive based.
I guess to get back to this, tariffs, I mean, I think a lot of people understood tariffs against China or other countries that have been accused of dumping steel and aluminum. But when you have tariffs against our partners like Canada, it's less understandable, and especially of concern, like I said, to the automakers.
Sure. So I support the concept of fair trade and putting tariffs on. I didn't support on Canada per se. I supported it in concept in the beginning to make sure that we have fair trade. And really what we're trying to do is make sure that we hold accountable our trading partners for fair trade and have a trade that's more balanced, and so that we can, again, bring those good-paying jobs back to our communities here in the 7th.
You and your opponent differ on positions on legalizing recreational marijuana in Michigan. Tell me where you stand on that ballot proposal.
I think that's a very controversial ballot proposal. I think there's a lot of pros and cons to it. I talk to a lot of people across the district, and I hear very mixed feelings. So my position on that is I would be a representative of the people. So if the majority of the people in the district vote for it, I support it. I support medical marijuana. I think that medical marijuana is a very viable solution for a lot of folks, and we need to talk about it, and ultimately we'll see what happens in the polls.
One of the concerns that Wahlberg brings up and gets back to economy is that a lot of manufacturers are finding that the applicants for jobs don't pass the drug test, the mandatory drug test that they have in many companies, but for insurance reasons. How much of a concern is that?
Well, I think, you know, other states have dealt with legalizing marijuana. I think that's something that we would have to deal with. That's what I would say. I hear from public safety. I mean, I hear from a lot of different perspectives. And I think that's part of a job as a congressperson is to listen to all those perspectives. But at the end of the day, if the voters in this state want to have recreational marijuana, I will support that with the idea that we will make sure we address those concerns that we have. The thing about the workforce is that we need to get more training and job preparedness. We need to get the folks that are living in the 7th the ability to get trained in those skilled trades so that they can get in those good-paying jobs close to home.
As you know, there's a deep partisan divide in this state and in this country. How do you think we can get past that?
Well, you know, as a small-town mayor for 14 years, I worked with two previous congressmen, Joe Schwartz and Mark Schauer. I think that when you focus on solving problems and not come from it from a partisan perspective, It's very easy to do. It has a mindset, though. I think you have to listen to understand folks from different points of view. But at the end of the day, I believe very, very strongly that collaboration and working together, I think different ideas and more ideas actually makes a better outcome than just one single narrow agenda. And so I actually am really excited because I've been recruited to join the Problem Solvers Caucus. I don't know if you've heard about that, but that is truly a bipartisan caucus. And the chair has heard about my interest in being bipartisan. And I asked if, you know, Mr. Wahlberg was on that. And he said he's not. He's a very conservative congressperson and he doesn't fit the bill. But basically, the caucus is if I join as a congressperson, as a Democrat, I would need to find a Republican. And they do the sticky issues like affordable health care and immigration and gun safety. And so those are things that are really, really important to the majority of our constituents. And they want to see somebody working across the aisle and stop saying, well, you're from this party. But what's the issue? How do we solve it?
Gretchen Driscoll is the Democratic candidate running to represent the 7th Congressional District. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me here. It's great to be here.
So few people know what it's really like to be at opposite ends of the same career path. Enter our new series, Work in Progress, conversations between two people, one just starting out in a career and one who's been working in that field for a long, long time. Today, we hear from two people who have chosen to be Roman Catholic priests.
And may the Lord bless both of us, the Father
and the Son. And Lord, may you be in our thoughts during this time, on our lips, and in our hearts. Let us think like you, let us love like you, and let us live like you. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Father. My name is Father James Hobeck, or Father Jim. I'm from Church of the Holy Family in Novi, and I'm very grateful to be just a newly ordained priest.
And I'm Father Ed Pruce, and I've been a priest for 57 years.
57 years.
And I retired now and living in St. James Church in Ferndale, which is now called our Mother Perpetual Help.
Just some questions I'd like to ask you. What were some of the best parts or things that you can remember of being a priest? Like, what would be your, would you say, one or two strengths?
You know, Jim, I never thought I could do certain things, but I was amazed. Like, my first assignment, I went to into the city of Detroit. I rang the doorbell. This elderly man answered the door, and I said, Father Uhlenberg? He said, yes. And the first words he said to me were, your day off is Tuesday. But to do the things that all of a sudden, I had never done these things before. I remember sick calls. I especially remember sick calls. And there was a little book that had the ritual for what to do when someone is sick, and they called you as a priest. I studied that in Latin all the time. How about yourself? I mean, these first weeks and months are exciting times. What's been going on for you?
Really, it's just learning on the fly. So I had the privilege of being ordained at the church at Holy Family in Novi. And it was a beautiful experience. But the next thing you know, Monday came and I was the associate pastor. You know, I had phone calls, emails, people asked me to do masses here, there, and everywhere. I was very excited to hear confessions. And so for me, it's been a very quick learning curve. And I would say that in truth, like, life has been very busy. You know, there's been a lot of activities. Also, too, we have the Spanish Mass every Saturday.
You speak Spanish?
Oui. Un poquito, you know. And that's a challenge. I took 4 years of French in high school. There was something I was hoping to do. But in truth, my grasp isn't great. I probably speak like a child. But I'm open to learning. I'm open to practicing and to learn. So these first few months of priesthood have been incredible. So, Father Pruce, just wondering, how has the life of a priest changed? You know, you were ordained 57 years ago. What do you think it looked like back in the 1960s as opposed to here in 2018?
When I was ordained, our understanding and appreciation of the priesthood, at least mine, was that we were supposed to be doing everything. And what has happened is amazing, that it's like the Spirit of God in the people of God has just called their gifts forth. And so all of a sudden now you have people who are ministers of the Eucharist. I mean, that was not even imagined at the start with us. Only the priest could distribute the Holy Eucharist. Only the priest did the readings at Mass, led the prayers. All these gifts that have been buried in the community, all those years, you know, and people just came and it's like the church has come alive.
What would be one important piece of advice to give me?
You know what, Jim? I'd say this. Love the people. Yesterday, I was in the hospital. I had to get an X-ray taken. And the woman who's taking the information says to me, "Are you Father Proust, who used to be at Shrine?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "You married me." I said, "I did." She said, "Yeah." I said, "How's your married life? Did it work out?" And she said, "It was marvelous. My husband has passed away, but I have two beautiful daughters now, and we've had a wonderful life." Just to meet people like that, it's always the voice of God in our lives. You know, people are really marvelous, and there's so much goodness in them. And all we have to do is, we're like the treasure finders for God. That would be my advice.
Thank you. I do appreciate that. It's important because I'm learning, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that I always wonder about when talking with the young priest is like, was this a difficult decision? Because in our society, you know, like priesthood was considered, I don't know, just it was treated with awe, if I can say that word. It was something that people looked forward to. In this day and age, though, the way society is, people say, "Why would you become a priest?" And I wonder if that was hard for you. To be a priest in today's world is a challenge.
Yeah. There's no doubt about that at all. I mean, when I was in high school, that was something I had to wrestle with. Is like back when I was a senior, that's when I first started thinking about priesthood. And one of the challenges a lot of my buddies would ask is like, "Well, you're never going to get married. You're never going to have kids. You can't have sex. You're not going to be able to live." And I remember even at that point in time, that didn't sound right to me, but I wasn't able to articulate a response. But that's something that during my time of seminary, I did have to wrestle and pray about, is that, yeah, if I'm going to be a priest, there is great sacrifice, that I will not have a wife, I will not have a girlfriend, that as a celibate man, I will live on my own. And one of the biggest obstacles I had to get over was looking at it, rather than being a prohibition or a condition, a freedom. And so for me, yeah, there is an incredible need for courage to be able to be firm in my commitment to celibacy, to live chastely, to recognize that a lot of the culture around us mocks or doesn't value chastity. They look at it as a chain or something that enslaves people. But instead, there's actually great freedom, you know, to love not just, you know, people as objects, but people as persons.
It takes courage. But that's true of all vocations. It takes courage. And, you know, so often people say, "Well, you're not going to have any children, and you're not going to have a family like other people have." But all families become yours.
Well, Father Proust, I just want to say thank you. I told you that there are a number of priests who are somewhat jealous that they couldn't be here talking with you. But you've got a ton of experience, a ton of wisdom to share. And in this brief period of time, you did. And all I can say to you is thank you. I'm very humbled to be here just to share this time with you. And I do ask that you please pray for me.
Well, Jim, I will pray for you. But I'm thanking God that He sends you, because I think you have a lot to give to his people, you know. We're called to nourish each other, and I think you're the man, the right man for the job. God love you, Jim.
God love you.
And your ministry, too. And don't forget, if anybody's listening to this, say a prayer for Jim.
And say a prayer for
all
Father
of
Ed.
Us. Yes.
Amen. Amen.
And that was recently ordained Father Jim Hobeck and recently retired Father Ed Pruse talking about their lives as Roman Catholic priests. That's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.